Strange. I seem to remember that the cathedral was on the other side of the square. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Cable Car, the only podcast in the world dedicated to celebrating films where cable cars explode. Now, the 1960s were the golden era for big, sprawling epics about World War II. From Men on a Mission movies like The Dirty Dozen or The Guns of Navarone, to historical recreations like The Battle of the Bulge or The Longest Day, it seemed audiences couldn't get enough of three-hour-long films where Hollywood stars got to machine gun hordes of obliging German extras. So on this show, we're looking at one of the most decorated examples of that illustrious genre, a film where the only thing exceeding the running time is the body count. It's 1968's Where Eagles Dare. Given the nature of this film, it's only fitting that I bring along a token American on my mission to review the film. So to make sure this podcast isn't an all-British operation, I'm joined once again by my good friend Nick Rehack. How you doing, buddy? And are you ready to show me your papers?
I'm doing very well, and yes, I have them right here.
Okay, well, I hope they are going to pass muster, otherwise you might be quickly taken into custody, and I can't guarantee what the Gestapo are going to get up to once they take you prisoner.
It wouldn't be so bad if I'm in like a really nice hall with a big fireplace, because you know that's where really where you interrogate people, not in dank dungeons, but
exactly, yeah, with a large
halls.
Brandy in front of you. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I can't wait to be arrested myself. But now, when I suggested reviewing this movie to you, I was shocked, I tell you, to learn that you had never seen Where Eagles Dare. Now, this film is an institution, and certainly on this side of the pond, it's a television staple. I mean, if you are a British man over 30, I would say it's almost impossible that you have not watched this film at some point. So, yeah, what the devil have you been doing, Nick?
Everything but watching this movie, apparently. I'm not pleased to admit this, but over the last year, I finally watched Bridge Over the River Kwai and The Great Escape. So I'm still catching up on some of these big, sprawling epics, and I'm just not doing it fast enough.
Well, I'm glad to be able to help you take this corrective action and catch up on some of these classics. I mean, what did you make of Bridge Over the River Kwai?
I really, really enjoyed it. It was the first time I've seen Alec Guinness in a non-Star Wars role, and I was just pleased by his acting. I enjoyed the entirety. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I really thought it would get kind of old or hackney because of how old the film is, and you know, many other films that have kind of harped from it, especially when they're whistling the song and walking around and everything. But I found it to be pleasant and enjoyable is not the right word, but it's just a very good and very well done film. And it's something that I definitely picked up on Blu-ray because it's something I want to rewatch and revisit. That's how much of an impact it made on me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's an excellent movie. I mean, and Alec Guinness gives a fabulous performance in that film. And William Holden, as another token American, is great in that film as well. So, yeah. Well, it seems to be a real theme for token Americans at the moment.
It just takes one.
That's all you need.
That's all you need is one.
Yeah. Two is one too many, definitely. But, and obviously, Bridge Over the River Kwai, a very famous exploding bridge movie. We obviously are here to talk about an exploding cable car. So, why don't we get stuck into Where Eagles Dare? So let's listen to the names of different actors being read by a stern-voiced man.
Richard Burton.
Take your clothes off. Don't argue. Take your clothes off.
Hello?
Clint Eastwood.
Now with McPherson dead, there's only five of us left. So you either let me know what's going on, or there's only going to be four.
The company that brought you The Dirty Dozen and the author who gave you The Guns of Navarone, Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood.
Lieutenant, drop that gun.
What?
Drop that gun and sit down.
What the hell are you talking about?
Where eagles dare.
During World War II, the Germans capture an American general who has full knowledge of the upcoming D-Day operation. To stop the general divulging details of the Normandy landing, Richard Burton is tasked with leading a crack commando team of British agents to rescue him. Amongst the team is an American Ranger, played by Clint Eastwood, who is puzzled by his inclusion in an all-British operation, and when one of the team dies after the parachute drop, Eastwood suspects that the mission may have a much more secret objective. Alongside Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood, we have a host of British thesps, Patrick Weimark, Michael Horden, Donald Houston, and Mary Ure. We also have the always enjoyably hammy Darren Nesbitt and horror icon Ingrid Pitt. The film was directed by Brian G. Hutton, who also made Kelly's Heroes, XYZ, and Nightwatch. And it was based on a screenplay by the novelist Alistair MacLean. The film was a big hit when it came out and has gone on to be regarded, if not as a classic, certainly as a classic war movie, if you can understand the distinction I'm trying to draw there. The film has a 7.6 user rating on IMDb and a 3.7 out of 5 rating on Letterboxd. So, Nick, this was a first-time watch for you. What did you make of Where Eagles Dare?
It was different than I expected and what I thought it was going to be. I was expecting something a little more war-heavy and not so tight, close, and intimate as it was. So I thought having kind of a spy take on it, especially for something in the 60s like that, was a really cool look at the film in perspective rather than a big sprawling war epic, which I also would have been fine with. But overall, I didn't care for it.
Oh,
because the first half takes so long to get to where we need to be. And then from there, the action comes in and really ramps up. But by then, I'm still confused by some other parts going on to where it wasn't fully enjoyable. I couldn't fully immerse myself in the moment, which there's some great action sequences on here. Implausible, but great action sequences nonetheless. And there's definitely moments and pockets that I enjoyed, but there wasn't enough spread out throughout the film to make the whole experience enjoyable. Not saying I had a bad time watching it, but it didn't scratch that itch for me.
Oh, well, I'm very stunned here, because when we were setting this podcast up, I was going, "Oh, you know what, Nick, you're going to enjoy this. I can't believe you've not watched this film. Yeah, you're gonna love it." So perhaps I built it up too much. Perhaps I set myself up here, for an inevitable fail.
Well, I had no idea about the movie. Even when I popped it in and started watching it, I didn't read a synopsis or anything. So really, that's kind of on me for not tempering my own expectations and figuring out what it was going to be about. And like I said, there's still a handful of moments I enjoyed, but just I couldn't get into the film. Maybe on a rewatch or on the big screen, it might have more of an impact. But just on this first go-through, it didn't quite put its hooks in me.
Well, you do mention something which is definitely true about this film. It does have a very deliberate pace, and it is sort of determined to show you every step of the process of how they're going to do this mission. So before they even infiltrate the castle, we see them painstakingly prepare their escape routes. We see them check out the bus. We see them plant the explosives. We see them climb on the cable car. Then we see them ride the cable car. Then we see them climb the walls of the castle. I mean, you could contract all of that, but this film, it's going to show you every single stage of this. And I mean, it does chug along in some ways. It does chug along a bit like a cable car. It's slow, it's steady, it moves at a very deliberate pace, and you can just sit there and enjoy the view. I mean, eventually, obviously, all hell does break loose in this film, but even then, it sort of doesn't necessarily quicken up its pace. It's quite striking, and it is unusual. I, though, enjoy that aspect of it, but I guess I guess it just that just didn't land for you, though, did it?
It didn't. And one of the big things that took it away from me at first was they're infiltrating a German base. I mean, it's a gorgeous castle, but essentially it's a base. But at no point are they attempting a German accent. At no point are they trying to speak German. And even leading up to it, like going in for this guy, I understand that they wanted to set up a lot of misdirection and red herring. So when you have these twists and reveals, it should come across as more of a shock. But when they're setting everything up, it's so convoluted and so poorly explained and not really a good enough setup to kind of bring you in. For example, they talk about, you know, they're going to go rescue this guy. And, oh, he's not really a general. He's just an actor that looks like the general. And it's like, okay, so why? And then it's like, okay, if you're just saving an actor, why not just let him go and think that they have the information they need when really it's incorrect? And then it turns into something else. They're actually trying to get some other information instead. And I'm trying to catch up and keep going, but, you know, they're like, oh, go wait for me over there, and I'll be there in 12 hours. We wait the full 12 hours with that guy before we go over to that section. Now, I can appreciate how the film does take its time, and it's very deliberate, but it's almost too deliberate. There's a lot of stuff that could be trimmed down. Like when they're riding up the cable car,
yep,
we could have cut that down. We were literally with them the entire cable car ride. And as they're going up and down this cable car, I'm like, it's stationary. It's not going to move at all. Some of it, and maybe I'm being too harsh and too nitpicky, and I'd be the first to admit that, but there's just a couple things that just kept sticking out to me. And I'm like, stop paying attention and just focus a little more on the film itself and not the small details.
Well, let's discuss the action and the suspense sequences in this film. So, I mean, we get all sorts of different things here. We get intense machine gun battles. We get some sneaky infiltration, some vehicle chases. How did they contribute to the film? Were there particular sort of sequences? Were there particular sequences in this film that stood out for you? And if so, which ones worked?
I liked when Clint Eastwood's character, he and the major he was with, Major Smith, when he and Major Smith, when they surrender, I guess, and they're off in the car, I really liked that whole scene. They're all of a sudden, they overtake the guards that are with them, and they dispose of the bodies and dispose of the car. It's brutal. It's a lot for a film from the late 60s. But it's also an aspect that we don't typically see. If anything, they would have fought them, jumped out of the car, and the car would have rolled off the hill and done whatever. But instead, it shows them overpowering the guys, the car flipping over, them fixing it and sending it over the hill. And I appreciate those details in the action. And then there's some of it that gets very brutal when they're fighting on top of the cable car and then bang, ice pick into his arm. I was like, are we really showing this? Am I watching an unedited version here? Because this is pretty nuts for something out of the 60s. So the action and the tension is there. But like I said, it's just the spy stuff that it kind of takes away from it. And what's also nice is sometimes there's action pieces that are there for the sake of action or feel gratuitous. And even though this film has a nearly 3-hour runtime, I felt like all the action pieces worked. There was nothing that was too extra or too much or like, they could have cut that one. That wasn't as good. They all felt just kind of in a nice, neat little bow.
Okay. I mean, what did you make of the two leads that we get here? So obviously we've got Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood in the lead roles. I mean, you know, for me, Burton, it seems like he's in a bad mood in this film. He's very brusque as his character. Eastwood, he's very wry, he's very deadpan. He gets some one-liners that he gets to sort of deliver as if he's a sort of cool observer of himself in this film. I mean, did you enjoy their pairing?
When their pairing works, it works great. But there's some moments where it feels like they're butting heads even when they're not. Something about Eastwood's delivery, kind of a quieter yet smug and funny when he needs to be. Like, okay, it works, but is that the character? Is that the person that needs to be teamed up with Richard Burton's character? And like you said, Richard Burton just seems annoyed for most of the film. Like he almost as if he doesn't want to be there, or just something. Like, he doesn't get that. Just something feels off with him throughout most of the film, and maybe even he's trying to figure out the plot as he's speaking the dialogue.
Yeah, it's a very difficult one to work out, because Richard Burton, obviously one of the great actors of the British stage, you know, somebody who played all of the classic major roles of Shakespeare. And you sometimes get the impression in some of the films that he made where, you know, he was somebody who wasn't averse to taking a paycheck. He had very expensive habits that needed paying for. But he would often sort of appear in films and you'd get the impression that he was looking down his nose at the film that he was himself appearing in. So you don't know if his bad mood is him sort of like, oh, why am I in this trashy war movie? But then also, you know, was it that, or was it, I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with Richard Burton, but, you know, he was a massive alcoholic. And oh, wow. you don't know whether the fact that he, you know, maybe he was just in a bad mood, maybe he was just hungover, maybe the kind of the bad mood that he is in these scenes is just the product of a raging vodka hangover. So I mean, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to kind of unpick which of what was driving his mood in this particular film. I don't know. Yeah, in terms of looking down his nose or hangover? What do you fancy?
I think it's a little bit of both sometimes. looking down his nose for sure, because, and it's not that the entire plot is convoluted. I think it's just there is very dense exposition in bursts rather than it kind of being paced naturally throughout. They give you a whole lot of information dumped on you and not a lot of action to give you time to kind of let that germinate and then let the ideas grow within you. Instead, it's just like, here's everything you need to know, and he's saying it kind of fast and he's not really delivering it well, and how is he a major? How do these people like him? Like, what is really his relationship with all these people? I get maybe they're trying to do something to add to the mystique of the character because of how he presents himself and how he, it feels like every time we see him, he almost has a different motive, or there's some other aspect that he's working on that he's trying to keep secret. Case in point, when he's like, oh, I left that book, and he goes and meets up with a girl, and it's like, oh, hey, what's this about? And obviously we find out as we go along, okay, she's an agent too and all this other stuff, but I guess they wanted to add to the mystique of his character, but there's not enough charm there to kind of make that work.
Yeah, it's a very curious performance, because, as I say, because he does come across as if he's in an absolute foul funk in this mood. And I don't know whether he is trying to play, I mean, because he was not somebody who generally worked in the action genre. So I don't know whether he feels a bit out of his comfort zone and he's just trying to play tough. I mean, sometimes some of the scenes, some of the ways that he plays them, it kind of reminds me of James Cagney. It's almost like he's doing a sort of James Cagney impression in some of these scenes. Now, you know, Cagney, a great actor, and I think he was much more charismatic in terms of doing these sorts of roles than Richard Burton is able to pull off here. I mean, you mentioned also the exposition. I mean, some of the blame for the exposition that Richard Burton has to deliver in this film has to lands with Clint Eastwood, because he was, so the story goes, he was basically, I don't want to say all this, like, kind of, he was just cutting his lines wherever he could, and he was like handing dialogue over to Richard Burton. So I think, but
oh well, that's why he's annoyed. There's our answer. It's Eastwood being like, yeah, nah, he could say this. It's like, great, now I got to learn another line. That, and correct me if I'm wrong, it was filmed on location, correct?
Well, obviously, a lot of the exteriors were shot on location, but I think pretty much everything that is shot inside is in a studio in Pinewood.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, because if it was on location, then they're cold, and I'm sure that adds to the level of this is ridiculous. But if they were kind of inside, then maybe it wasn't so bad.
Now, I mean, this film, as I mentioned at the top of the show, is a sort of institution in the UK. The British Film Institute did a big celebration of its 50th anniversary a few years back. Steven Spielberg says that this is his favourite war film. Quentin Tarantino.
Really?
Quentin Tarantino is a fan of this film as well, although, I mean, Quentin Tarantino has declared himself a fan of so many films, I'd be more interested now in knowing which films he actively dislikes. But anyway, I mean, this was a first-time watch for you. I mean, you're not terribly keen on it. So I'm guessing, can you, from your interesting vantage point with which you're viewing this film, as somebody who is not particularly enamored by it, can you see why this film has lasted?
I can see for a couple of reasons. I think a lot of people appreciate it from a technical standpoint. It is a very good-looking film. It's really well shot. It's gorgeously lit in some moments, especially when you have it's not really the pinnacle scene because it's not really the midpoint of the movie, but the big scene in the lavish hall with the big fireplace, that's really well lit and it's really well decorated. The set and how some of the characters just come in and out of the darkness like that, it works really, really well. From an action standpoint, there's a lot of great chases. There's a lot of great explosions, especially the ice pick in the arm. That's, I mean, as gruesome as that is, it was like really cool to see them kind of push to that boundary. And there's a lot of projection work.
Yes.
With the front screen projection, some of it held up, some of it didn't, but I think at that time it was still a relatively new thing.
Yes,
so
that's right.
For them to use it as much as they did is impressive. And I think a lot of it is that. I think a lot of it is technical merit and maybe a moment or two or a couple pieces of dialogue, but I don't think it's like the product as a whole.
Fair enough. But just circling back around to this, the fact that this film is a British institution. I want to test you here. Well, I'm not really testing you. I'm intrigued to pick your brain because this is a first time watch for you. And there is a line of dialogue in this film, like many films, that has become synonymous with Where Eagles Dare. So if you said, oh yeah, I watched, you know, Where Eagles Dare at you at the weekend, you know, somebody would quote this line of dialogue to you to sort of indicate, oh yes, I know that film, you know, and I love it. I love it too. So as somebody coming to this film fresh, I was intrigued to see if you would be able to identify it. So yes, if you had to sort of pull out that one line of dialogue that signified, yes, I have watched this film and I am a fan of it. Do you know which one it would be? Can you guess?
The one that stands out to me, and I think it because it made me giggle the most, was, I'm an American. I don't even know why the hell I'm here. But then the other one I kind of liked is your opening line, cathedrals on the other side of the square, because that's one of those moments where I felt the tension shift and I'm like, oh, he knows. Like, he knows exactly, and he's going to break this whole thing apart.
Well, all great lines both. But I'm, yeah, it's not the one, though, that is synonymous with the film. So I'm going to give it to you, and I'll see what you make, you know, once I give it to you, I'll see what you make of it. So the line that is now famous from this film is the line that Richard Burton delivers when he is making his radio calls back to his British boss. So it's when he's tuning in the radio and he's going, broadsword calling Danny boy, broadsword calling Danny boy. That is the line that if I said, oh yeah, I watched Where Eagles Dare at the weekend, I would just go, oh yeah, broadsword calling Danny boy. Does that in retrospect, now that you know or are aware that that is the line, does that make sense to you? Or do you just think, what the hell?
No, that makes a lot of sense. And it does because Rambo, First Blood, does something very similar to that, where it's like lone wolf to wolf den, come in Johnny, something like that. There's a line like that my
Coven leader
always
to, it's Coven leader to Raven or something like that.
Something similar to that, but it makes sense. I'm like, okay, like I get that, like or Top Gun when they're they do the call signals and things like that. So I could totally see that as almost like a coded line to where, like, if you know, and if you don't, or if you're trying to pretend that you've seen it, they could call you out on it.
Okay, well, you now know how to fake fandom of Where Eagles Dare. if you feel under pressure and don't wish to reveal your true opinion of the other film, you'll know how to bluff it out now. But I wanted to give you a bit of a pop quiz on this one, Nick. So I hope you're feeling in a quiz mood here. So I've got a few facts and stats to throw at you. So let's do the kill counts of this film. How many people does Richard Burton kill in this movie?
I feel like it's more than 20, less than 30.
Okay. So let's split the difference. Let's say 25.
Okay, that works. Okay.
It's 52.
Okay, way off. All right.
How many people does Clint Eastwood kill?
Now he's got a couple.
He really goes to town.
Hallway.
Yeah,
he does. Like that hallway scene where they're chasing after him and he's just mowing down entire hallways. I was like, what is happening? Well, if he's 52, let's go 76.
Ooh, much better, but a little way off. He kills 99 people.
Oh my! What's one shot? We couldn't do 100.
I know, it's very disappointing. I'd be calling my agent. I'd be like, we need to demand a reshoot where I kill an additional German to get me over the line into three. And lastly, how many people does Mary Ear kill?
I'm gonna say, let's go Baker's dozen at 13.
Oh, very good, Nick. 16.
Okay.
Very good. And I got two more for you. Two more.
Yeah. Ready.
How many bottles of vodka was Richard Burton drinking a day on set, according to Darren?
Oh, this is
according
a real
to Darren
question.
Nesbitt.
That is wild. Well, what are we considering, a bottle like a fifth or like a 20-ounce bottle? Or?
Ooh, see, now you're throwing your sort of strange American metric system at me. So I would consider a bottle of vodka as 700 milliliters.
Okay, I can work with that. Let's go four bottles a day.
Oh, ding, ding, ding. Exactly right. Hey. To be honest,
you got breakfast, lunch, dinner, and a midnight snack.
Apparently, Richard Burton, when he was making this film, went off for a boozy weekend with his regular drinking or his Hollywood drinking buddies of like Peter O'Toole and Trevor Howard, and I forget who the other guy was. Well, went off for a weekend. Apparently, didn't make it back till Thursday. So this was the level of. Fortunately, there was so much sort of. Famously, Clint Eastwood has said that this film should be really called Where Doubles Dare, because so much of it is done by by stunt doubles. But lastly, my last pop quiz question for you is, how many times is the great action film dialogue cliche line, "We got company," said in this film?
It was.
I mean, normally it only gets said once because screenwriters have restraint. But
yeah,
that's not the case in this film.
But not at all. I'm going to say 22.
That is ridiculous. People would be saying that every other line if it was like, okay.
It felt like it.
It's said three times. It's said three times. Which, as all I say, right. Normally. It's like we're one and done in a film, but I can't think of another film where, and I have been cataloguing films where people say "We got company." I don't know yet of another film where that line is delivered more than once. It's Where Eagles Dare is an exception in us getting to see it, well, getting to hear it three times in the film.
That's well, I mean, to be fair, I nailed the last question, so I had to ridiculously overshoot this one.
Yeah, you've got credit in the bank. You've got credit in the bank. So, I mean, you know, you absolutely nailed the Burton vodka stat. So, yeah, I'd be basking in the glow of that for at least a week. So,
I'm gonna.
Okay, I think it's time to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding cable car action.
in a world where podcasts already seem to address every imaginable subject, one man broke new ground with a seemingly random obsession about exploding helicopters in movies. He was a podcaster on the edge, a maverick broadcaster who played by his own rules. Now, he has a last chance to talk about the strange way helicopters explode in film. Exploding Helicopter, available on iTunes and Podomatic now. Think you know about chopper fireballs? Think again.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding cable car action. This occurs in the sequence where our heroes look to make their escape from the Schloss Adler castle with the two remaining British traitors in tow. The perfidious pair overpower Clint Eastwood and jump aboard a cable car to evade our heroes. Burton jumps on the roof of the cable car where he plants a timer-controlled bomb that causes it to explode. Burton then hooks up with his buddies again as they look to evacuate the castle in the remaining cable car. By now, the Germans have cottoned on to what's happening and have set up a machine gunners to intercept the cable car as it arrives at the bottom of the mountain. Clever Dick Burton has anticipated this move, and our heroes jump from the cable car into a handy river, leaving another timer-controlled bomb behind to blow up the Nazis who are waiting for them. Nick, what did you make of the exploding cable car action?
I thought it was fantastic. It's always great to see Nazis get blown up. But what I really appreciated, and it didn't even dawn on me that this would be the case, how horizontal the explosion was. Mm. I mean, obviously with the windows and how it's designed, it's going to go jetting out. But I mean, it went wide, and I was so impressed by it, I kept watching it and just really appreciating just that style, because it's not like a huge, you know, fireball or an explosion like that. It's still an explosion, but just how the flames escape the vehicle itself was really, really cool.
Yeah, I loved them both in this film, and I particularly loved how after the explosion the flaming remains of the cable cars fall to the ground. I mean, particularly the first one, because obviously that's falling, you know, hundreds and hundreds of feet down into the valley. The other cable car obviously is only falls a much shorter distance because it's nearly at the bottom of the mountain, so it doesn't have as far to fall. But still, we get to see the flaming wreckage of it. Fall from the cable down to the ground. I really appreciated the way that they kept the combustion going for us to enjoy the fiery remains of these cable cars expiring their last on the screen.
Yeah, especially because a lot of explosions in general, we don't really hang on the explosion. We catch the explosion, we get a residual 3-4 seconds to react, and then boom, it's back to the action. And there was times like this, especially with the fall with the car, it almost felt Looney Tunes-ish in how it falls for so long and then eventually bursts again. But it's also not a lot of films do that either. It's always very quick. Obviously, they only get so much budget and they're trying to get the best shots that they can and use what they got. Or with CGI, they don't want to have to spend so much. So I get it. But it's nice to see in a film like this some appreciation and them really just taking their time with it, letting it breathe, you know? Like a bottle of wine, letting it breathe and enjoying it.
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes filmmakers can get, you know, distracted by the idea that we're concerned about the fate of the characters in the film. And really what they fail to appreciate is actually we're much more interested in the exploding cable car than we are in whether Richard Burton is still clinging onto the side of the cable car he's just jumped onto. So I appreciated that Brian G. Hutton here, the director, just stayed on the cable car. Like, we got plenty of time to, you know, reveal the fate of Richard Burton. Let's just stay on this shot. Let's give this cable car a proper funeral on screen in this film.
Yeah, it's what professionals do, and it's what legends do. Plain and simple.
Exactly. I couldn't have put it better myself, Nick. Okay, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Nick, thanks for joining me on Exploding Cable Car. Before you throw yourself out of the plane, would you like to take a moment to plug anything else you've got going on?
Yes, if you head over to rabbitholepodcasts.com, there's a myriad of shows I'm on too. You can check out Lyrical Innuendo. It's a music-based show, as well as Play MST for me. It's a show all about Mystery Science Theater 3000. If you're looking for something a little more on the action side, I was a recent guest on the Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast. Host Mark Hoffmeyer had me on, and we discussed our favorite action hero movie names.
Sounds very intriguing. I'll have to check that one out. As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Cable Car website for more reviews and information about how cable cars explode in films. We'll be back soon. But until then, what should people do, Nick?
Keep watching the mountains for those exploding cable cars. This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Well, is that it, Major?
Yes, that's it, Lieutenant.
Do me a favor, will you? Next time you have one of these things, keep it an all-British operation.
I'll try, Lieutenant.